Great. Welcome to session 801. Where have all the binders gone? Managing archives with databases. And this session is being recorded. So when we get to question time, make sure you keep your questions short so that we can repeat them. And we'll try to do that. Also, I'm also supposed to say that the presentation today, the slides will be available on the SAA website at some point. And we're going to follow the more traditional format of the three of us speakers will speak all at once and have questions at the end. I thank everybody for staying around for last session, last day. We really appreciate it, and I hope we have something interesting for you to say. My name is Greg Colati. I'm the Digital Initiatives Coordinator at the University of Denver. I have with me Jennifer King from the George Washington University and Sylvia Augustine, also from George Washington University. Prior to me being at the University of Denver, I was also at the George Washington University for a while, and what we're going to talk about today is one implementation of how we brought automation and database software to a particular special collections and archives institution. In my career in archives, I've actually automated four different institutions, one as large as a Division I research institution and as small as a very small historical museum. I really believe that the use of databases and management systems open up many opportunities for archives and archivists to manage their content and also to deliver that content to their users in creative ways. But like I said, today we'll just be talking about one thing. Jennifer King will speak second, and the title of her talk is,
It's New Skills in the Digital Era.
Right. And actually, this is an update and continuation of the talk she gave about a year ago at the symposium that was organized by Richard Pierce Moses. So Jennifer has some really interesting and good things to say about the skills that archivists need in the digital era. Sylvia Augustine, Sylvia and I go way back. when we both lived in Boston, we collaborated on some projects. Then I hired her in to work with me at Tufts University. And then when I went to GW, she happened to move to Washington, too, and I hired her again. I don't think Jennifer's going to let me take her to Denver with me, but you never know. Sylvia has a lot of skills in data manipulation and reconfiguring data for different uses. And she's going to be talking about some of the things she did in the GW database project. But first, I'm going to have a much more theoretical discussion of the value of using databases to manage archival collections. My first question is, of course, where have all the binders gone? And for many repositories, the binders are still sitting on the shelf, and they're still the main point of access. For others, they are being converted into EAD XML and accessed through standalone systems or as part of aggregators like the Online Archive of California, the Northwest Digital Archives, the Rocky Mountain Online Archive. Getting from binder to EAD is crucial in participating in the global information discovery process that tens of millions of internet users are engaged in every day. But the point that I want to make today is that EAD is simply not enough, and we must do more with the information we have about our collections than merely produce EAD. And I'll talk more about that as we go along. Leaving binders behind is more than just an opportunity to participate in the next grant or to trade hole punching for XSLT creation. Leaving binders behind is a way to envision a centralized management and administrative access to our archival collections while supporting multiple discovery points to our materials at the object level. When I think of databases managing collections, I think of scale. I think of the ability to manage large quantities of data about archival holdings in one central place to be accessed and referenced and reused by a number of stakeholders and audiences. people like the acquisitions archivist or the processing archivist or the reference archivist or the intern or the serious researcher or the historical hobbyist or even the K-12 student. Databases, though, support more than access. They support management functions as well. Administrative information, things like accessions, donor information, exhibit information, loan information, and more, can all be stored in relational tables alongside our descriptive and access information. This information may have been scattered in multiple backroom binders that rely on human knowledge to connect to the collections we steward. Even the documentation relating to our collections, things like deeds of gift, donor agreements, etc., can be stored and managed as objects in a database management system. While all of these factors certainly support a move to management with databases, I think the real drivers of change are digitization, born digital content, combined with researcher expectations. All of these things really demand that we manage content at the item level. So the talk of binders really is just a metaphor for saying that the archival tradition of a finding aid acting as both a management and an access tool no longer supports the increasing demands that are being made to archivists in the digital world. So I'm not going to, you know, persist with the binder metaphor, except leave it up at the top of the screen there. What I'm really saying is that database-driven collections management systems separate the management of our content from the way we can provide access to the content. And that is really a really important distinction and something I'm going to talk about today. Because this really supports reusability of metadata and collection information in a variety of delivery systems and aggregators. For example, by using output templates from a database, I can, with the push of a button, use the same data to create an EAD finding aid of an entire collection, a collection-level MARC record for my library OPAC, hundreds or even thousands of individual item records for inclusion into a catalog or index, or something like a TEI XML image book that presents the digital surrogates as a work unto itself. These are just some of the examples of the ways that if I have my content in a system that is able to be manipulated, I can output it in many ways and in many places without having to go back to the data and re-fiddle with it. I'm sure there's a much more technical term for that. Most importantly, I think, database management systems allow archives to approach their collections from the context of content and metadata management rather than from collections management. That is, we can begin to think of the material in our care as objects that have a variety of attributes, only one of which is provenance. And while provenance is important, it's not the only way that we think about our collections. So I could create virtual artificial collections of objects that are, say, from a particular historical era, or that are made of similar materials, or that are diaries, or that are green, if that's the way I think researchers need to access or want to access this content. The ability to rearrange the material intellectually through access tools may even lessen the temptation to physically rearrange collection materials in the box or on the shelf. In a paper-based world, the finding aid provided a link between content that was managed through provenance and original order and the needs of the researcher, who often sought information based on subject or name rather than provenance. Since no matter how thorough a finding aid was, it was a slow and time-consuming work to ferret out the information needed from multiple repositories and collections. In fact, in a strangely counterintuitive way, the more complete my finding aid, the more time it took a researcher to go through it. For years, archivists stood as the intermediary between the content and the researcher, either by creating elaborate name lists, indices, guides, and calendars of collections, or simply by what I call digesting or internalizing the contents of as many collections as possible so that they could provide the kind of random access research service that the researchers demanded. Through automation and digitization, however, a researcher has the potential to have a more direct relationship with the collection material. And we're not going to talk about like the psychic trauma that causes to some archivists. We'll just talk about how it's possible, this is possible, and only, though, in cases where the collection material is discoverable and available to the researcher without going through the intermediary of the archivist. This doesn't mean that the archivist is now left out of the process of discovery and access. In fact, the archivist's job is even more important, because the archivist has to not only describe the material under his or her control, but to make this description useful and also interoperable in multiple contexts. And I see that how and what we describe may need to change as we begin to manage our content more and more at the item level. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a minute or two. The development of EAD is an attempt to make finding aid creation more standardized, useful, and interoperable. And this is a good thing. While EAD, however, provides a somewhat standardized structure for describing archival content, it really wasn't until the publication of DAX that the archival profession made an aggressive effort to standardize descriptive practices. As we know, DAX was built on Steve Henson's APPM, and DAX is far more comprehensive in its approach to prescribing archival description. Yet, while both DAX and EAD, standardized description at the collection and series level, neither has much to say about description at the item level, creating a situation where it is still very difficult to exchange or interoperate archival information at any level using EAD as a transmission or exchange standard. As I said, moving from paper binders on the shelf to EAD finding aids and contributing those finding aids to EAD repositories, it is a good thing, but it is not nearly enough. We can do much better with the information we have available than to just exchange its paper-based access format with an electronic one that mimics the paper finding aid and with really the exception of text searching, has a similar limitations in that it imposes a particular organizational outlook on the material, and this organizational outlook may not be what the researcher is looking for. Simultaneously with the development of EAD, a number of organizations pursued different courses. They created homegrown systems to manage archival content using database tools. I don't know if anybody was around for DBase, DBase 3, DBase 2, all that, right? If anybody remembers DBase. Then we moved to things like Access or FileMaker Pro. And here, the burden of the do-it-yourself made it very difficult to manage, sustain, and develop these database systems. To fill the void, archives management systems vendors sprang up to meet the need for managing archival collections in automated ways, and now we're seeing the development of open source solutions as well. Most of these systems work reasonably well, but since they are all necessarily based on a loose interpretation of archival descriptions, since there is no standardized description below the series level, each system is essentially unique, and there's a lot of difficulty exchanging information between them. Furthermore, each system was essentially created to manage information within the sphere of the repository, and the emphasis was on getting information into the system, not getting it out. Export functions originally were generally aimed at creating printed finding aids. In recent years, vendor systems have been moving toward a more interoperable system with MARC and EAD export functionality. Now, these developments in the archival world follow some 25 years or so behind the library ILS development, where in the 1970s, management and inventory control systems evolved first to solve management issues, and where OPACs were then later added on almost as an afterthought. Library users were forced to learn how librarians manage collections in order to use the library catalog effectively, and many bibliographic instruction librarians justified their existence by insisting that students and researchers had to be educated to use the library catalog rather than trying to make the catalog more useful to the library researcher. In the past few years, the trend we were seeing in libraries is to move toward what they're calling a user-centered approach to access and research by replacing the OPAC with component-based systems that separate management aspects from user experience and provide users with data visualization techniques that focus on interrelationships, concept mapping, and clustering. How interesting would it be for us to see a graphical representation of the items in archival collections with nodes representing clustered subject terms in the way that this example of a biological documents is shown using something called Aduna and Carrot 2 software. And this is developed at the National Research Council of Canada. This essentially is a visual representation of documents that have common things in common and the relationships between them in this cluster map. Or perhaps researchers could more easily dig through our collections if we use something like this bungee view, which was developed at Carnegie Mellon, that lets a user visualize the scope and breadth of a collection through the use of expanding and contracting bar graphs. So the resolution on our monitor is not very good, but what's going on here is that different attributes of these collections items are shown in these different bar graphs, and I can, if I click on one, it expands the bar beneath it, and then I pick another subject and expands it beneath it, and I can do all sorts of essentially Boolean searching without ever understanding what Boolean searching is and without ever actually having to type anything into a search box. This can happen with our archival collections as well if we make our metadata granular and reusable. By and large, however, the shift from management-centered to user-centered access has not yet begun in the archival profession as a whole. Just when libraries are moving to create user-centered discovery and access systems that are separate from their management systems, the archival profession continues to push for the creation of electronic finding aids, which is essentially a management-centered approach as a solution to modern archival access. The good news is that there are some topically-based projects, collaborate projects out there that focus on subject access to primary source material. One of my favorites is the Electronic Encyclopedia of Chicago, based right here in Chicago, and the New Jersey Digital Highway, which is another example that comes to my mind. The slightly discouraging news about this, however, is that these projects are generally led by librarians and computer scientists, and archivists tend to be along for the ride. And my opinion is that we should be leading these kinds of things as much as librarians and computer scientists. I'll talk a little more about that in a couple minutes as well. In the archival world, really, even the few research projects that are looking at how researchers interact with archival materials have maintained the traditional top-down, general-to-specific description paradigm that has been the staple of archival processing for the last century. Using a database approach to manage metadata about a collection really requires us to have a cultural shift in thinking about how we do our jobs. Yet this step is really not a very big one. And by taking it, we will be able to open up our exciting opportunities for providing access to primary source material in our care. Exactly how any particular user-centered approach to archival access would work is relatively unimportant to talk about right now. What's important is to understand that content that is discoverable and ultimately accessible at the item level will be used most frequently by the majority of our researchers. This can only be done by managing our collections as close to the item as we possibly can. All of us who work in collections have anecdotal and certainly documentary evidence of the fact that photographs that have been published or that appear online are more often requested than photos that are hidden in folders or file cabinets, even if there's an extensive finding aid for the collection in which they are a part. If we want our collections to be used more extensively, we have to make a commitment to item-level management and access, especially of our digital content. And I'm sure people are out there saying, oh, yeah, sure, fine. How do we do this? Well, how do we do this? How can we manage our collections at increasingly detailed levels and manage the increasing amount of content that is coming at us and provide access in a variety of discovery systems? As I said, I think this requires really a cultural shift in how we approach our collections, our processing, and the delivery of our collection content. More specifically, we can do this by taking some steps, both as individuals and as a profession. The first thing I think we need to do is extend interoperability. Develop standards for archival description that extend to the item level. This would require us to more explicitly and systematically identify through metadata schemas the hierarchical relationship among objects in a collection and the difference between the intellectual constructs like collections and series and the physical objects like folders, files, and the like. Other disciplines have already approached this and done this sort of work. If anyone's familiar with the Visual Resources Association and the VRA Core and the accompanying handbook cataloging cultural objects, does a very good job of understanding the relationships of items and their parts and how things go together. We need something like a CCO for archival description. The second thing I think we should do is start to manage from the bottom up instead of the top down. We need to focus on metadata and content management instead of collections management. Rather than crafting beautifully written research essays and historical and biographical notes, we could focus more on the objects in our collection and begin looking at the material in our care as objects that are associated in many ways, only one of which is provenance, and begin to build systems of access that and approaches that can leverage these associations. We can collect and organize material on the fly according to preset criteria, like collections and series, and allow users to self-identify collections based on the research interests and searches that they want to have. Another thing I think we should do is take a productivity approach to processing, management, and access. And here again is where using database management systems to assist you really enables us to increase our productivity. We can automate data creation for groups of similar objects by using defaults, macros, or incrementing functions of database programs. For example, using a default function, I could create 1,000 records of a set of photographs of an event, and each record could have virtually the same metadata, including even the title, and differ only in the unique identifier. With things like thumbnail previews, the researcher can still differentiate among each of these 1,000 objects and make a decision about which object they wanted. This is you obviously can't read this. The title of all these records is called Football 1957. Obviously, it's not all the same picture, but we automated the creation of this the item records in the database, and gasp horror, we scanned these using a sheet feed scanner and ran them through. This whole process took about 15 minutes, and we had something like 151 item records that were digitized. Now, these were modern 20th century prints, of which we had the negatives, so we weren't really too afraid that if the scanner ate one, that we were losing a precious historical resource. What I lose in specificity here, I may gain in quantity. Is the reward worth the cost? Well, if my access system allows user-contributed metadata, I may be able to harness the power of the masses to do my cataloging for me. Of course, we all know that that requires us verification and fact-checking, but I think that sort of thing is far preferable to not doing it at all. Again, we need to use the power of database tools to manipulate collection information for export. As I said earlier, on one record, I can produce multiple types of exports. The collection management database can not only take information from a number of sources, but it can also export that information in a number of formats. We also need to leverage the use of digital repositories and consortial digital repository programs. We don't have to do everything ourselves. We can become content experts, outsource the low-level functions, but we need to understand how these low-level functions work and ensure that they meet archival and preservation standards. And that's where our knowledge of archival and preservation standards can inform the builders of digital repositories to build them in ways that support the things that we need to do. Another thing that I think is far more important is we need to meet our new best friends. We must begin to forge connections with librarians, computer scientists, and academic technologies. We must attend and participate in meetings like the Joint Conference on Digital Libraries, or IMLS's WebWise, or the Coalition for Networked Information Task Force meetings, or EDUCAUSE. I go to meetings like this, I participate in them, and I don't meet many archivists there. Why is that? We need to go to these places. We can't just come to SAA and congratulate ourselves on all the great work we're doing creating finding aids. We have to go out and talk to these people and make partnerships with them. We have something valuable to say. When I talk to computer scientists at these meetings, I get these responses of wide-eyed wonder because they think they're alone in figuring out interrelationships among objects and collections. And I go, archivists do this. We've been doing this for years. Let me tell you what it's like. And they get all excited. The next thing, and we've heard a lot about this this week, we need to get into the flow, right? Can we all say Google or MySpace, YouTube? This is where people are. This is where our content needs to be. Finally, I think we need to create access tools based on user needs. Well, everybody would agree to that. But ultimately, I think we need to understand how our constituencies seek and use information, and when those information gathering activities change, we must change our tools with them. And this can be done if our tools, our access tools, and our management tools are not bound together. If we can separate those things, then when the tools change, we just send this stuff out in a different way. If we can do these things, if we can, and then, of course, stop doing some other things, we can position ourselves closer to the center of the world of information management and delivery. If not, we risk becoming increasingly marginalized as others take over not only the delivery of content, but the stewardship of it as well. The other two speakers today will talk about how one institution approached the transition from finding aids to databases and of the new skills needed to do this and some of the techniques used to move from a finding aid-based management system to an item-based one. And I'll ask Jennifer to come and talk a little bit about the new skills for the digital era. Thank you.
So what I'm going to do is piggyback on Greg's talk about theory and actually talk about the real-world practice that we did here at GW. In the winter of 2005, the Special Collections Department of the George Washington University took steps to transform our management of collections by implementing a new collection management system, upgrading our scanning equipment, and reorganizing our staff training. Prior to this initiative, Special Collections neither produced nor managed digital materials on a significant scale. We did not have a departmental scanner, our local server quickly became overloaded if used to store digital content, and we had limited delivery options. Our finding aids were available in our reading room in three-ring binders, and most departmental tools for locating materials were not accessible to researchers. This situation had become untenable because of changes within the archives community. Researchers requested digital content, and donations arrived in a variety of formats. Our patrons no longer asked if we could produce a digital surrogate or if we had material available online. Rather, they expected to receive a digital copy via email or the URL for a collection's electronic finding aids and digital content. We were staffing three desks on two different floors of the library, and each of our three units had different tools for accessioning, processing, and accessing materials. The department realized that if we did not make immediate changes, we would be unable to provide researchers access to historic materials. We decided to move into the digital era by purchasing and implementing a collection management system, or a CMS. This presentation will discuss why we took these steps, how we took these steps, and the lessons we learned. In addition to our above-mentioned limited capabilities to produce digital content, we had other collection-related consideration that influenced why we took these steps. The January 2003 report titled Market Survey of Commercially Available Off-the-Shelf Archival Management Software states that an institution's needs must be the determining factors in choosing a CMS. Special Collections was concerned by the underutilization of our materials, and we attributed this problem in part to their lack of discoverability. We needed to solve three issues in order to provide access to our collections and thus increase usage of our materials. Consideration of these three issues would most influence our choice of a CMS. First, we needed to make our presence known in the place researchers now go for information, the Internet. Second, we needed to use automation to maximize our efficiency in the use of staff resources. And third, we plan to use the opportunity provided by a new CMS to employ national standards such as EAD and DAX. So the first issue we addressed was user expectations. As a university repository, one of our primary missions is to support the curricular needs of students. Today's students use the Internet as their primary research tool and have come to expect immediate answers to their reference queries. This immediate availability of data is particularly problematic when it comes to using primary source materials. It is difficult to entice undergraduates to take the time needed to use primary source materials, so we needed a CMS that would increase the likelihood of their finding good and appropriate metadata online about a collection within our repository. The description would have to include enough useful data to entice them to visit the library. In addition to undergraduates, most other researchers expect to find data about a collection online. They want this information available at all times and from any place, not just when we are staffing a reading room desk. Consequently, we needed a CMS that would provide metadata about our collections to the broadest possible audience. The second issue we addressed was automation. For us, the CMS would replace a combination of Microsoft Office products, including Access databases, Excel spreadsheets, Word documents, and paper documents that had been used to manage the department's three collections, Washingtoniana, the Kiev Judaica collection, and the University Archives. Since we already had many collections processed with finding aids, the CMS we chose needed to be one that could handle large-scale data conversion, requiring exporting, cleanup, and importing skills. A CMS could capture the metadata once and produce multiple outputs that reaches users in many places and in many ways would allow us to meet our goal of increased accessibility while using our staff resources efficiently. It is at this point that the issue of staff training became an important consideration in our choice of a CMS. The third issue that we addressed was standards. Prior to selecting a CMS, we used several homegrown and idiosyncratic tools to manage our data. One way to maximize accessibility of our collections is to use standards such as EAD, DAX, and MARC. A CMS would also allow us to implement departmental standards for data related to accessioning procedures and processing and unprocessed collections. So how do we go about taking these steps? After determining our needs and selecting our goals, we began our search for the right CMS. We looked at a lot of different databases, but we sort of focused more heavily on two and did, you know, sort of online demos for those, and that was Rediscovery and Minisys. It quickly became clear during our online demos that Minisys was a more advanced system than could be handled by a department with no prior automation experience. The second system we reviewed was Rediscovery. Rediscovery allows for the large-scale conversion project we required in order to populate our database with metadata about our processed and our unprocessed collections. Further, since the library's IT department did not have the resources to devote staff and time to supporting a CMS, we required one that included technical support such as that provided by Rediscovery. In addition, Rediscovery is capable of achieving our goal of increased access to our collections with their product, Rediscovery for the Internet, an online search tool for the database. We anticipated providing an online catalog of our special collections manuscript materials accessible from our webpage. Based on our review, the department selected Rediscovery. Following our choice, we began an assessment of our collections to determine if our finding aids could be configured to meet DAX standards. We also determined the best methods to import collection data into Rediscovery. First, the entire staff undertook the task of assessing the finding aids. Second, we hired a consultant to review the results of our finding aid assessment to assess the skills our staff brought to the tasks and to create a plan to implement the data conversion process. This plan included specific information about how the project should proceed, the skills the department already had, and the additional skills that would be needed. At the same time that we were implementing Rediscovery, other changes in the library increased our involvement with the creation, management, and storage of digital objects. These changes informed our purchase of a CMS and specifically Rediscovery. The George Washington University is a member of the Washington Research Library Consortium, or the WRLC. One of the missions of the WRLC is to provide consortium members with technologies to support digital collections. Toward this end, the WRLC operates two instances of DSpace. The first one is called the Research Commons and is meant for use by faculty members. The other one is called the Digital Object Catalog and is meant for use by special collections departments. Using this institutional repository solved our potential storage issues, and Rediscovery solved our management issues. Now we had the ability to manage, store, and provide digital materials. With these two infrastructure needs met, the staff could focus on how we plan to function within this CMS world. Three questions needed to be addressed: what equipment would be required, what skills would be needed, and how would we train staff? The Special Collections Department acquired shareware and purchased other hardware and software based on an assessment of our current and future needs. Our new equipment, new standards, and new CMS required the identification of the new skills the staff needed. We identified basic skills by looking at the work we were currently doing. For example, all staff members needed to know how to scan and clean up digital surrogates. They also needed to know how to use OCR software and how to search and edit records in Rediscovery. For this basic skill set, we wrote step-by-step procedures and provided each staff member with hands-on training. Advanced skills needed by selected department members included the creation of derivatives and EAD finding aids and the ability to navigate in DSpace. Individual staff members were assigned to master each task and provide guidelines and tutoring to his or her colleagues. For example, Sylvia managed the containerless conversion project. She prepared guidelines and taught the necessary skills to staff members working with her. Because of her written tools and training, the project continued seamlessly when she temporarily left the department. Our work in creating resident experts, training manuals, and departmental tech support continues today with monthly technical support training sessions. Our final goal in adopting a CMS was to bring the Special Collections Department into compliance with national standards. This was efficiently accomplished with Rediscovery. For example, Rediscovery's use of a template for finding aid creation allowed for the encoding of more than 100 finding aids in approximately 6 months. In addition, the authority tables in Rediscovery allow us to maintain standard subject headings. This use of standards, both in subject headings and encoding of finding aids, positions the department to take advantage of future collaborative work with other universities and to make our material available to harvesting tools. So what do we look like now? We have been working with Rediscovery for 2 years, and our Special Collections Department is quite different today than it was when we first selected the CMS. Currently, we manage all activities related to collections using Rediscovery. We have online access to our finding aids, which meet EAD standards and are in XML format. We also submit our finding aids to ArchiveGrid, so they are accessible nationally. We have an online catalog that lists both processed and unprocessed materials, so that patrons may search down to the folder level for relevant data within our collections. And we use DAX and MARC when we catalog materials. And this is an example of the search screen for our online catalog. This is the Rediscovery for the Internet. As a department, we have developed step-by-step guidelines for activities such as accessioning, data entry and Rediscovery, and finding aid creation, cleanup, and submission to the online catalog. We track both the intellectual and physical attributes of a collection from the moment it enters the library. Prior to our implementation of Rediscovery, researchers had to know that GW housed a collection relevant to their research, they had to be at our website to find data about our collections, and they had to visit our reading room to use our finding aids. Now, our finding aids are discoverable to a national audience and, of course, are discoverable to Google users. Similar to most archival repositories, Special Collections creates and acquires increasing amounts of digital content, and Rediscovery provides us with a way to make the material accessible to researchers. The digital objects are stored in our DSpace instance, but the link to the display JPEG is through our internet component of Rediscovery. Patrons searching our database have a link directly to the digital content that exists for a collection and the ability to use it from anywhere. As a department, we now know what a large-scale conversion process entails, what kinds of planning we need to undertake, what benchmarks we need to use, and what questions we need to ask. There is no doubt that the move to a CMS was the catalyst for the advance that the department has made in managing our collections and addressing the needs of our patrons. Maintaining intellectual control of our collections in one location has made management of these collections easier and more efficient and freed the department up to pursue long-term goals. This does not mean that the implementation and use of our CMS has been without its challenges. One component that attracted us to Rediscovery was its web interface for searching and browsing, known as Rediscovery for the Internet. We anticipated that our researchers would be able to search our catalog on the Internet from their home computers. Having an online catalog that permits patrons to conduct keyword searches in any field at any level of a database is a potent research tool. What we were unprepared for was the expertise we would need to prepare the web interface for use by patrons. Luckily, we had a staff member who could teach himself the necessary skills, but that process took much longer than anticipated. Long-term projects such as our data conversion project may last beyond the tenure of some staff members. This is especially true in our department because we rely quite heavily on student assistants. The training documents and detailed written instructions we created to train new staff members were crucial in our success in implementing Rediscovery. Document and imaging editing skills, however, have proved difficult to teach using step-by-step written instructions because it is impossible to anticipate all the issues a staff member will encounter. Therefore, we have come to realize the importance of the mentoring procedures as a training tool. Another lesson learned from undertaking this large-scale project is that these projects are often marathons, and it is essential to include milestones along the way to provide the staff with a sense of accomplishment. With our new digital capabilities, our interactions with donors have changed. We now explain to donors of paper records how new technologies will increase exposure, access, and use of the collection. For those who donate born digital materials, we need to convince them that we have the technical expertise and archival training to care for their materials. In this way, the CMS is actually impacting how we interact with donors and is helping to grow our collections. Currently, we have realized that Rediscovery may not be the tool we stay with long term, but the lessons we have learned will remain invaluable as we move forward. Fortunately, we have developed what is perhaps the most important element of success, a culture that embraces digital technologies and accepts the responsibility to master the required technical skills. In retrospect, I believe this was accomplished in two ways. First, no one was expected to master every skill immediately. Rather, each staff member focused on a manageable section. Second, once a staff member had mastered the assigned skill, he or she became the resident expert. This sense of ownership enhanced the person's identification with the new technology. Of course, new technologies appear frequently and new projects emerge from our interactions with constituents. We need to remain eager to learn and include them in our daily work. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for those of you who are staying around. We're the last session, the last day. I'll be telling you about the third and final step in our journey from binders to database management of our collections. This is the nitty-gritty, I would say. Jennifer has explained that staff members each became resident experts in their own respective portions of this project. And let me just say that that's a very generous term. I will say that on my end, I developed skills in one particular step of the conversion process. And then in the interest of the project and in my own best interest, I quickly taught several other people everything I knew so we all could share the workload. Today, I will be sharing with you some of the specific methods that we use to convert our finding aids from paper to database form. Some of you may already be familiar with some of these processes, and to you, I count on you to help me explain them well. Others of you may not be familiar with them, and to you, I will say that I'm going to be relatively detailed, not to show how complex this project was, but actually to show how surprisingly straightforward it was and easy to learn in the end. And so I suppose the subtitle of this section should be, "If we can do it, so can you." As Greg and Jennifer have explained, our goal was to save the information in our finding aids in database format in some way. And as you can imagine, some elements of finding aids are easier to get into database format than others. In addition to the copy in the black binder, we usually had electronic copies of our finding aids in Microsoft Word on our servers. And so this meant that we could simply cut and paste things like scope and content notes and series descriptions right into the rediscovery fields. Even in cases where we didn't already have an electronic copy, where we only had the paper, we could scan and OCR them. And so we were able to populate the higher levels of description in rediscovery relatively easy. And so we soon had skeletal records for many of our collections that included scope and content notes and series descriptions. What, of course, would not be so easy was the conversion of long lists of item-level records from all of our finding aids into the database. It would have been prohibitively time-consuming to cut and paste or type in every folder title of every collection. We had hundreds of collections, each with hundreds and some thousands of records. The next question became, then, how could we introduce some automation into this process? How could we get our item-level lists into a format, starting from Microsoft Word, into which a database could recognize what part of the text was the folder number, what part of the text was the title, and what part was the date? And how could we put all those values into their respective fields within a database, all so we didn't have to do it by hand? Greg devised a solution to this problem, and I improvised on it, and eventually we made some significant progress. We called it the Container List Project. What concerned us initially was that all of our container lists seemed to look slightly different. They'd been written over the years by different people, and this seemed to complicate any kind of automation. What we soon discovered, however, was that there were really not that many different ways of saying the same kinds of things. We knew we needed to find, like I said, numbers, titles, and dates. And as it turned out, there were not that many different ways of writing those things. I give you some examples. I don't even know if it's big enough to see. They differ really just in spacing, in number format, and punctuation. And so the differences were small, and generally within each finding aid, these tended to be consistent. And where we saw consistency, we did see some hope for automation. And let me add here that when I refer to items, this item level in our institution is a folder, not an individual document. We did not have it that well described to the item level. And so the next step was to save these container lists in a text editing program we used, TextPad, and to manipulate this text to tease out each element of these titles. It turned out that Rediscovery would be able to import the data directly from this simple text editing software, placing all of the elements in their appropriate fields, as long as it was able to recognize where one element ended and the other began. And it recognized these beginnings and endings using delimiters, which are special characters placed within the text to separate the elements. We could choose our own delimiters, so we defined the asterisk as the start and end of a field and the percent sign as the boundary between fields. We could choose any characters we wanted as long as we were careful not to use characters that might already appear as part of the text itself, and we don't really have any math documents or anything that would have percent signs. So, This makes a lot more sense visually. So if you just see up there toward the bottom, the first line of a title is just number one, correspondence, and the date. And the item with the delimiters inserted separates out first the one, then the correspondence, then the dates, and divides those between those with the percent sign. Once we specified where each element began and ended, we went ahead and imported the text into Rediscovery and specified the fields into which each element should go. We could essentially tell the database, the first element that you find, delimited out, will go into the number field, the second will go into the title field, and the third will go into the date field. And I just made them different colors, but the bright green doesn't really show up, but you can see that. But just as we didn't want to have to type every single folder into a database, we also didn't want to have to insert all of these delimiters into our container lists by hand either. That also would have been prohibitively time-consuming. So fortunately, we would not have to. Regular expressions. We automated the process of adding delimiters to our text using what are called regular expressions. A regular expression is a string that uses special characters, such as these listed here, to match patterns of text within a document rather than specific text. I found this cartoon on the web on someone's blog, and I shamelessly reproduced that. I'll read it. It's a little hard to read. Here we have an elaborate fantasy scenario where knowing regular expressions allows our hero to save the day. Oh no, it reads, the killer must have followed her on vacation, but to find them, we'd have to search through 200 megabytes of emails looking for something formatted like an email address. It's hopeless. And then we hear from our hero, everybody stand back, I know regular expressions. So we're heroes. In that case, our hero needed to search through a lot of data to look for an email address, presumably some text followed by an at symbol and a .com or a .edu at the end. In our case, we needed to search through a lot of data to look for the different elements of our item titles, the number at the beginning, the title in the middle, the dates at the end, and insert our delimiters between them. While we were at it, we also inserted the correct number of zeros into the item number as needed by the database. So we essentially aim to turn a page of this column on the left of titles into a page of this column on the right. It's not as attractive, but it's much more useful. These are really not attractive. Here are a few examples of the kinds of search strings that we wrote, and I'll just walk through them briefly just so you know what we got ourselves into. And the first example here, we wrote an expression to add in the zeros that I mentioned and the delimiters just around the item number to turn that purple text into the blue text. And in English, what we're asking here is for the expression to find any digit followed by a period, that would be the number one here, and replace it with four zeros and the delimiters. So after we'd run that search and replace, we wrote an expression to add in the delimiters between the title and dates to turn that blue text into the glowing green text. In the second expression, we are searching for any four-digit number preceded by a comma and space. That would be finding the date and replacing the comma and the space with our delimiters. And so in these two steps, we have added the delimiters that are necessary to export these items from our Word and then TextPad document right into the Rediscovery database. As you can well imagine, this method was not perfect, because not every title in every container list is separated from its date by exactly one comma and one space. And so we wrote dozens of regular expressions for each container list to try to encompass all of the possible style variations. But because we saw the same kinds of style variations in all of our finding aids, we eventually knew nearly all of the expressions that we would need for all of our finding aids. And it's true that we often had to tweak these expressions for each new finding aid. And it's also true that this type of search and replace can get you into trouble sometimes if it replaces more text or different text than you intended. So the journey from binder to database always requires some quality control and can certainly never be completely automated. And finally, there were occasionally hiccups in the final step where we exported data to Rediscovery. Just like every line of code has to be correct for a web page to appear the way you want it, every delimiter had to be in its correct place for Rediscovery to recognize the data. And while we did occasionally find ourselves asking whether it might not just be faster to type everything into Rediscovery ourselves, the answer to that was always no. So here's a shot of the item level view in Rediscovery with one item's number, title, and date in the correct places. And it's small, but it's a beautiful, beautiful picture. Once our container lists were in Rediscovery, as shown here, we could easily create EAD finding aids from them using a template that we created. And so now, instead of the black binders, we have 257 collections, each with an EAD finding aid, all searchable and browsable online, and zero binders. Thank you very much. I turn it over to Greg, and I guess we're ready for questions.
Before we open for questions, again, I'll say that the presentation will be available on the SAA website, and I want to thank Sylvia and Jennifer for being so open to change and embrace technology. When I first came to GW, as I think Jennifer said, you know, things were done in paper, in binders, and we were foundering. We couldn't keep up with the demands. And the idea that we embrace technology as a solution, not to do our work for us, but to help us be more productive and more efficient in how we did our work. Now they have, you know, probably more than 257 finding aids, but not only more than 257 finding aids, the information they have in the collections management system is reusable in multiple ways. The evolving database search engine allows people to access things in all sorts of different ways. So that, I think, is the another idea and another lesson that I took from this project. So we're happy to open this up for questions on anything for anybody. I'll moderate the questions, and then I'll look over there for answers. Sure, in the back.
Who?
Yeah. So the question is, using databases, you can make associations that are not obvious in the paper. You can do things that aren't possible in the paper, like search through thousands of items at once. Is there an example that we can give of something in this project that where we found something that I guess that we didn't know was there, or that these things didn't go together. We didn't understand that they went together. Are you going to point this out?
I don't have a specific example, but one of the things that is really valuable about Rediscovery is that the web interface, when you search for a topic, you're searching multiple collections. And so you can find, you know, folder titles that all have that same topic from five or six different collections all at once. I don't think any researchers approached me. People will come up and say, here's a list of things I want to see, and it's for multiple collections. I'm assuming they're doing that because of how the database works. So I have seen that. I don't think I've had my aha moment, but I've seen that.
I think another point is that the clustering engine I showed you there that was developed in Canada automates the creation of the clusters not based on any authority list but on the content of the document. So it does document analysis and then creates those clusters. So those things are created on the fly based on the power of the algorithms and the semantic analysis that goes on. If we can get our documents in the kind of formats that these analysis engines can analyze, we can discover all sorts of things that we don't know are there right now. How many items in the database? The question is how many items are in the database, and how many people do you need to make those? We just need Sylvia.
Well, I can tell you.
It's just Sylvia, that's all.
No, I can tell you that in terms of the conversion process for me, it was myself and then one or two grad students, and then I taught you, didn't I? No, I mean, it was a matter of a handful of people, three or four people. As to the actual quantity of items, I mean...
Tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands.
I mean, you know, yeah, I mean, each folder, I mean, and we say item, we're really talking about the folder level.
In most cases.
Except
for the photo collections.
Tens of thousands.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, and then Sylvia passed it off. I think we had probably one full-time staff member dedicating two full days and then two grad students working on it the majority of their time on our staff, so probably another 20 hours. And it may have taken a year to do the Washingtoniana portion. The University Archives is still doing their portion. So the more people you have, the faster it'll go.
Right. Some other questions, comments? Sure. Do you hear that? Good. Repeat the question.
I suppose the question was, were these legacy finding aids we were working with, or were we creating new material? Is that your question?
Right.
So the differences were relatively surface differences. So they all had scope and content notes. They all had series descriptions. They all had administrative information. And so... Okay. Maybe Greg wrote some of those. By the time they got to me, they all had those things. The complete challenge was taking the legacy finding aids into this database format, but I found the differences to be relatively small. Greg?
But as far as legacy finding aids are concerned, when we did the initial analysis of the collection, we ranked all the information we had about each collection on a number of criteria. One was readiness and the other was research value. And so some collections had very high research value, very low readiness because they maybe had item lists, but no scope notes, no biographical notes, no nothing. And those things had to be created from nothing. What we did, we assigned this stuff out to everybody, and we had this thing on the wall where people crossed stuff off and got all excited about watching the wall fill up with blue marker. It was really great. But we also, in order to make that process go faster, we created a very specific guideline for how to write a scope note and exactly what would be in it and how long it would be and in what order that you would say. So, for example, a biographical note would always start with, I think, the person's name, their life dates. You know, I think there were like three other things you had to say, and then you were done. You know, don't spend 3 weeks researching this or researching that or finding out who his second cousin twice removed was or anything like that. It's like there are five things you say. Once you say it, you're on to the next one. You know, there was a specific way to talk about, and if you look now at these, we had to go back and fix a lot of these things. But if you look now at these finding aids, you'll be able to read one scope note and the next one will be written exactly the same way. You know where that information is. And we standardized it and we shortened it because we thought getting people to the stuff was more important than telling them about it.
You brought me in after you'd done all that. That's great.
Yeah.
That's hard.
Well, actually, Jennifer did most of that. I just told her to do it. Yeah. We called on.
Yeah, basically. The
question was, what's the relationship between the collections management system and the digital repository that's run by a third party? Within the collections management system, there's a field that has the unique identifier or the handle for the object. And... right now, I think all the objects that are delivered on the website are pulled from the digital object management system. So if there's a picture of somebody, George Washington perhaps, that picture is not pasted into the finding aid, but is in fact referenced in the code, and it pulls the access copy from the digital repository and puts it on the screen. So when we talk about, you know, do it once, use it often, that was the whole idea. The digital repository, since each object has a unique identifier, which is supplied by us using the collections management system, it can be referenced in any document anywhere, used over and over and over again, without us having to know anything but its unique identifier. The question was, have we done any studies now that there are essentially two different ways to access the same content? Have we done any studies of what people are actually doing? Jen, I don't think you've done that. I think it would be a great idea.
Yeah, I like that idea, but no.
And I think there are a number of ways through web blogs and surveys that that could be done, and I think it'd be a great research project. Maybe we'll find some money.
We'll get a grad student to do that.
Good idea. Yeah, and I think that would be really valuable information to have. Sure. I think there's a question in the back. The question was, how do we get the storage space in the digital repository, in the DSpace digital repository? That was you want to explain it? You want me to
Take it? Well, the only thing I know is that, so we're part of a consortium, and the consortium hosts that instance of DSpace. It's a dark archive, so they may have ideas to open it up at some point, but now it's just a back-end function.
Well, it's not actually a dark archive because it's just not publicly accessible. Right. So we put all that stuff in, but it's not accessible through that.
Right.
There's no public interface to that. It's only accessible through the tools that we have. So as part of the consortium provides digital content storage. So we didn't have to build that. It probably would have been impossible to build it ourselves. No, I don't say probably. It would have been impossible to do that. The library didn't have the technical staff in its systems office to do that sort of work. And we were lucky that, well, we weren't lucky. We pushed it very hard in the consortium to get them to provide that service. So when I say things like we don't have to do this ourselves, we don't have to do this ourselves. There are, there were, I don't know how many other schools in the consortium, 8, 10, 9, something like that. There were 9 other schools that had the same problem. And by solving the problem together, we probably got more out of it than if we had each tried to do it alone. I'll let you answer that, but first I'll say that our goal here is not to advocate for any particular software product. I think Jen said it very well when she said it was an analysis of need. There were no open source options when we started this work, what was it, 4 years ago? Right, there were no open source options. The vendor we chose because they had a track record of providing good customer service. Was it custom? They did some custom work for us, but not really that much. As much as we sort of could nudge them into doing, oh, come on, we really want this. And there were the usual, things when you implement any new system. We didn't know how to work it, so we'd have to call up Monica and say, Monica, we broke this. What do we do? And she'd say, oh, Greg, stop clicking on things you're not supposed to. Stop opening up the hood there. So it really wasn't custom built. It was essentially off the shelf. They did basic customization of data entry screens like field labels, if we wanted to use our terminology.
And we still call their tech support. I still call Monica. So I think there's the usual, database issues, nothing unusual.
There was a time that we entered a whole bunch of stuff at the wrong level. And we said, these are really supposed to be items. How do we move these 500 records? I don't really want to erase them and retype them. And, she would come in and did something and it was fixed. It was great. Other comments, questions? Sure.
Yeah, so you have
the output templates. Yeah. So, if we needed to send every one of our photo records to, the Library of Congress or something, to be included in some project, we just say what's the data exchange standard, and then we would write one little template and then export, X thousands of records. If we had to migrate completely out, again, it would be an export template. What is the data format that whatever system needs, rather than having to, that would be it. What is the data format the external system needs? And it could spit out whatever it wants. That's, I guess, the beauty of separating the information from the information management or information delivery system.
And okay. So I would say certainly the great leap for us was getting it into a data format in the first place. I mean, certainly it's possible that we'll use a different vendor, we'll have different needs in coming years, but that's not nearly as intimidating as having to get it there in the first place.
You will never have to reformat the date field. You will never have to reformat the, where is the title. You'll know where the title is. You never have to reformat the box or folder or item number field because it's a number now. It's not an I. So that by standardizing all of our information, it makes it infinitely more interoperable because it doesn't work just in this system. It will work anywhere. It's data. So we separated the data itself from the management of the data. Way in the back. Are born digital records included?
Yes. But the university archivist would have to answer the question about institutional records. But we do receive born digital records, not too many, but we do have procedures for entering them in the database and then storing the actual object in the digital object catalog and having the handle within the item level record of rediscovery.
And as far as collections management goes, an item is an item is an item, and format is irrelevant. It's the management of that item that's important. And a location field that says that is a handle to a digital repository is just the same as saying it's on shelf 39, whatever. I don't even know. All right. Sure. We'll go way in the back and then in the front. Right. I'll try to summarize. If we went in for essentially item level access, do the records speak for themselves, right? And I think they can if they carry with them contextualizing information. So if you saw my slide before of the pond there, it says, I am a JPEG, I am a TIFF, I am part of this collection, I am part of this series. Because if I'm really interested, I will dig up, not down. Okay, so my theory is that people want to find something and then they want to find more stuff like this rather than saying, I'm going to go to the papers of so-and-so to see if they have whatever. They want to find whatever they want. And then find more things like that. So if we have contextualizing information, if I really want to know more about Abraham Lincoln because I found the letter of Abraham Lincoln, all right, well, maybe I already know enough about Abraham Lincoln as I need to, and I just want the letter. So I want that letter. If I want to know more about it, I can go up the chain and get to the general description that should exist. But I shouldn't be forced to start up here and get down there to find that letter, because all I really want is a letter. I'm sorry, yes, in the front, you had a question. The digital object is not attached in the database, it's referenced. So when, we didn't have an example up there of the Genie system where if you did a search for images and there were the pictures of buildings, those thumbnails actually are being pulled from the digital repository, they're referenced in the database. So, that way they can be used and reused infinitely. I don't know how many images are in the database. I'm going to ask you more questions you don't know the answer to.
Not many more than when you were working for us, Craig.
But you got to get back to that.
Yeah. We probably have maybe 500 images that are referenced with a digital object. I mean, we have more images than that, but those are the ones that are scanned and referenced.
And that would be a separate project to digitize those.
And we would love to do audio files. We don't yet, but we'd love to.
But that's just a matter of what you're going to do next rather than the capability. The capability is there. Manage the object, reference the object from its place in that repository. Okay, I think that are all the questions. We'll be here for a little bit. If you want to come up and ask questions privately, we thank you for your time and interest, and hope we've given you some things to think about. Thank you very much.
Thank you.